session number 3966, reel number 6.
John Milne, take number 6.
So, as I was mentioning in Zarya here, we had also this staff record, staff list, so that we were able to get in touch with any district officer and any complaints or worries that our soldiers would have, we were able to send to them, and they immediately cooperated and investigated the circumstances. If it was wife trouble or anything like that, they were able to sort of report in, or parents were ill. So this was another valuable background to my training, still in my first tour, which was most essential with these African troops. We had to make them happy, and if there was any problems, we were able to do this. So it was very good. So learning the language was very, very important indeed, and it was most valuable. Now, the training, to come to switch again from learning the language, our African training, as I said, was in various stages, but there was one thing that I was very interested in was PT. And as I mentioned earlier, having been in the display team in my depot before coming out, I was very fond of the Africans with PT. So we always did our PT in the early morning, was the coolest part, and when we did have PT, and they loved it. And I can tell you, when you see an African body with just a pair of shorts on, they've got wonderful physique. And again, through having to learn the language, I was guided by my African sergeants and others through about different things. And I was able to introduce, much to the fun, I asked permission from my RSM first, about introducing African games into PE, into PT. I mean, the usual movements in PT, which was all right, but I used to finish off always what was called Jock's Mad 10 Minutes. I became sort of known, and it was much to the enjoyment of everybody else, where we would do PE exercises and running out and so on like that. And then these, I remember, they were just recruits from their own countries, from their own villages, I should say. And I would, by word of command, I would just say, monkeys. And of course, they immediately started antics. You could picture, say, 30 men or this group all acting as monkeys and getting up to escapades. Then I would, and deer, in the language, of course, you see. And of course, then there was one man would be the lion, and the other the sort of herd of deer, and they would be scampering, and the lion chasing, racing around, this sort of thing. Which, of course, I was helped by my African sergeant, who told me all these things, games they play in the villages. So here was an opportunity whereby these youngsters put far more into their exercises and their fun and game than they did in all the usual arms bend, arms stretch. So fascinating. It became quite a joke, and I had to sort of invent invent by the Africans themselves, because they loved it too. Anyway, that was PE in particular. Otherwise, it was the usual weaponing and drill.
How did they react to this ordinary weaponry and
drill? Oh, they're keen as mustard.
Did they learn quickly?
Yes. And of course, it's all by word of mouth. They had to learn everything. And the only thing they had was the English word of command, but given by Hauser. Well, of course, your African sergeants and corporals did that, but you were there to see to carry out the movements correctly. But again, it was your job also. You see, you had your African NCOs, which you then gathered at the end of a week, as the case may be, and you would go through any points that wanted to be corrected and so on. So they were as keen as anything to do their best, and they loved it. And for drill parades, like what I mentioned, the regimental past, the regimental day, they were as proud as anything in their uniform, marching past and saluting whoever was on the stand representing the King of England. They took a pride in their appearance and their drill. This was the whole thing, and our job was to create a core or pride in the regiment.
Did they mix well together, coming from different places?
Our job was a European. You had various tribes, and they're not all friendly to each other. But our job joined out that they were the Nigerian regiment. And as our regimental colours, and the regiment tie is green, which represents the Mohammedans, black of the tribes of Africa, and the thin white stripe coming in the green, and the green was the white man who was there to unite as one unit. It was our job. And of course, we did have problems between the various little tribes among themselves, but that was our job to sort it out.
Can you remember any of these problems?
Well, it's like three or four Europeans even together from different parts of the country. And when you think in our country at the present, the problems we've got in Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and otherwise, visualise that a hundredfold of the different tribes and the different languages and the misunderstandings that can crop up. So really, there weren't problems. There's just a question of sorting things out and being able to sit and listen. This was the whole atmosphere. The time was no object. If there was any problems with Africans, you had to be prepared to sit and sift everything out. So that was the beauty of learning the language.
What sort of problems did they come to you with?
Well, there was, of course, if they happened to be, so you see, you had the case of older soldiers later on, I mean, having their wives weren't with them. They were back in villages. Family problems at home. They're getting letters from home, asking for things. They couldn't sort of either send money or didn't what to do and so on. So we had to sort all these things out. But of course there was also problems amongst themselves, friction amongst individuals that you had to sort out. You'd fighting amongst themselves. Well, of course, you see, they were fighting in barracks. Therefore, of course, they were immediately produced, and you had to sort that out, whether you decided they should they go in front of the company commander. Or another thing we had, you see, in the depot, or and also in the battalion, in the outstations, I say, the BNCO had the unofficial thing of going to be able to give confined to barracks, you see, without it wouldn't go on your character sheet. So therefore, you were responsible for it all. Offences, first of all, produced these people, and you had to really try them first of all. As I listen to all the evidence first, before you could decide whether you could, or they had to go in front of the company commander. The Africans knew this, and they accepted it. And again, this by not knowledge was a great boon. It was most essential. So therefore, you investigated whatever the problems were. And then you were able to say to the African concerned, right, would you like me to give you the punishment, or do you want to go to the front of the company commander? Well, they knew perfectly well if they went in front of the company commander, they were going to hunt down on their character, which they didn't like. They didn't like it on the book. So therefore, usually, in nine cases, and a lot of cases, you were able to deal with it just yourself. Mm. And you were awarded what would suit the crime.
But what methods for punishment?
Well, it was like defaulters for the British Army, and of course there were various things that were the opposite of them, and the tasks were very fitting to what you left then to the African Sergeant Major to do.
Was there any caning at all?
There was flogging days. So I'm glad about that. That stops.
Were the recruits taught any English at all?
Very little in the depot. The main thing, they were taught the words of command, and it was explained to them by the African sergeants, the African instructors, and that was all, really, because we didn't have time. But by the time they got to the battalion, then, of course, the battalion had a system of basic English, which they tried to teach. But in the early days, it was very... Well, you didn't have time, quite honestly. Not in the depot.
How long were the troops with you at the depot then, being trained? The
same idea, 6 months, but really it was more, because it took longer. It depended on the circumstances, it depended on the time and the season, because the rainy season, you were rather limited. And there was various other things were done during the depot, so you would say really it was nearer 9 months than 6 months. But it depended on the season and so on. Like, for example, again, this was another great thing for me. The time came when the recruits were ready to fire the rifles for the first time, you know, their final training before joining the battalion. And outside Zarya, there we had a camp which where the rifle range was. It was well 12 miles of anything, and it was just a little barracks where you had your housing for 40 roughly, allowing for other people. And the squad went out there to fire the rifles, fire live ammunition for the first time. But in addition to that, during the dry season, and this is what happened to me in my case, you see, I went there and I was there for roughly 6 weeks. Bit forget now, but the point was I was there just to do supervise all the firing of the. Of the live weapon training, as we called it, the firing, the live ammunition, and so on, like that. But also, for the remainder of the day, we got up early in the morning, down on the rifle range, and we fired and did about 9 o'clock to get all the cool and the best part of the day. Then they boiled the rifles and all that sort of thing, and the rifles were put away then for the day, and then the recruits were then used. They did a bit of drill. Just in practice, but they then went out to cut grass, sticks, and everything to maintain the buildings. This was one way. See, we were also maintained. We were a government department, the same as other government departments, and therefore there was not as far as possible. The barracks, you maintained your own barracks and did your own clearing up, bring up ways, and anything like that, if it was necessary. So in this case, this was the idea. So this, if you can picture this squad that was due to just fire the course, that was really the main thing. They'd done all the drills and all that. They were quite good at them. From the remainder of the day, they were out cutting sticks and oxen, bringing that in for the maintenance of the houses that were due for repair. Now, my squad was a SARA, you see, of course. It was all part of my training, you see. I wasn't, because they knew far more about that than anything else. Although the system was, as soon as owners and the NCOs concerned were off to do this sort of thing, or even do the mudding or building the houses, I was still being taught Hauser. And this was a good opportunity of learning all about thatching, the names, building the walls. Also, he worked in. He had various recruits that he thought would sit, and they told me all about the background of what they were doing before they joined up, where they came from, and I had to try to translate it into English to him, so that he knew that I could listen to them properly. So I got a terrific ground, which I'm most grateful for, because there I was getting recruits, or people telling me things that I had a clue of what was coming. So I got a lot of background of tribal and so on like that from these people.
Did you take an interest in tribal customs?
Oh, yes. Well, it was automatic. You did. And now, so therefore, I had all this ground over about 6 weeks. You see, as soon as this squad had finished their course, they were sent back to the depot. Out came the next squad to fire their, do their weapon training and all the remainder of it. Again, carry on with what we finish off what we'd carried on, building the mud walls, as the case may be, and so on like this. So we had a continual sort of, this is what's happening all through the dry season. So we would maintain the buildings and the range and keep everything down, bush down and so on like that. But at the same time, I was learning far more of the language, which was most interesting. That's the depot. So back now, and then I was back into the depot again after about 6 weeks, which I'd been out there, about 10 miles outside Zaria. So of course, on the weekend, I was able to pop in if I wanted to go to the club. Outside side interests were we had the railway club, where the railway, because it's a railway headquarters as well, and the two tennis courts, so we were able to play play was horse riding, if you wanted horse riding, polo if you were good enough. But I wasn't good enough in those days, our early days, but we did quite a bit of horse riding, and there was no golf course there. and otherwise it was just general interest, and there was race at the season. We also had race course. There was a race course in Zaria where the Europeans came from all over the world to do horses and so on. That so of course quite a social going on that way.
What was your accommodation like at Zaria?
It was the usual round mud house, grass roof. And
where did Proots live?
They were in the same as the same idea. All the barracks were based on the same idea. You had these round houses, each recruit, and in the Zaria, we had two recruits to a house, because there was quite a lot in the area to a house. They hadn't so much kit, you see. They only had their basic kit, and there was no wives and anything like that. So they were in these little round house.
What were the messing arrangements then, if there were no wives?
Well, that again was done by the wives of the CO, and also the Magadji. You see, we had a big. Not only we had the depot, the artillery were there too. What we call the light bag. They carried everything in their head, the guns and everything, just like the Olympic demonstration with the Navy. Similar ideas that. So there was the artillery there as well. So there's quite a lot of wives available to run the market. You see, in this case, you see, it was a combined market covering not only the depot but also the artillery. So you had a big marketplace belonging to the army, as you would say. So that overcame that difficulty. So it was the same thing, only larger.
Did you ever have any trouble at all with all these recruits gathered together without any wives? Their own?
No, not really, as far as we were concerned, because that was the duty of the RSM or the CSM and the sergeants and everything. They maintained the discipline, and you didn't see. If there was any trouble, a lot of things you never saw, quite honestly. And they were confined to barracks pretty well. They didn't need to anyway. They didn't have enough money to do anything anyway. I think it was nightmares a day they had then. Something like that. I forget from memory now, but they were limited with their funds anyway, and they really had village life, as one would say, and their entertainment and everything was in the barracks.
How long were you at Zaria?
Now this, I carried right. See, I went there when I was what? I had a good year, because I was I was in Zaria before I had 6 months service. That's right. So I did my first tour in Zaria. And it was most interesting. I could tell all sorts of stories from Mazasara, how the most simple thing, just what happened, and how the most simple things.
Give me an example.
Well, having known a bit about Nigeria before I went out, I took out hair cutting with me. One of the things I knew that was used to be a problem with cutting of hair. So before I went out, a cousin of mine who was a barber, who was a hairdresser in Keith, and I went through a course of instruction, because I'd been his soap boy years previous to earn some money on a Saturday. So I got up to date, and I went out with a clippers, just one clippers with the different combs on it, gave you the different heights, you see, and scissors and a comb. So that was one of my sidelines. I used to cut hair off my BNCO friend and officers. I didn't charge, because in the mess, I used to have a hair-cutting session in our mess. It used to be on the Mohammedan Sunday, as we called it, Thursday. And, of course, they used to put it in the swear box. So all the contributions used to go in the swear box. And that was opened and sent home for charities in Britain. Dr. Bernardo's in particular. This was all the messes had various ways of doing things. Anyway, this was my sort of indirect contribution of doing something. So I sort of was the unofficial barber, and it was quite fun, really. But to bring this story in, which again was in my young early days in Zaria, my problem was I could cut all the other people's hairs, but nobody could cut mine. So I said one day to one chap, I said, "Come on, Charlie," I said, "you cut my hair. It's nothing to do," and I showed him how the clippers worked, you see. And I said, "Go on, have a go." Of course, I didn't see what he was doing, and quite unthinkably, he went boom, right up the front part of my, above my ear. And then he said, "Ooh!" And of course, I discovered when he showed me the clippers that I hadn't put the comb on, and he was cutting with the bare one. And the result was there was me with this bit right up to the crown of my head. So I said, "Well, there's only one thing you can do now is cut all the remainder off the same." So I was then left with a little tuft in the front of my head, much to the amusement of all the mess. And of course, I got my leg pulled, you see. Anyway, I trimmed this down a little bit, you see, not thinking of what on earth was going to happen. Next day, when Mazasara appeared, you see, we were sitting there for our usual Hausa instruction. He was chuckling like anything. So, in perfect English, he said, "Ah," he said, "you've now got your first Hausa name." So I said, "Oh, what?" Because you get nicknames, but you never hear them, because they're very appropriate to what your character is, you see. So I said, "Oh, what's this one?" He said, "Oh, now," he said, "you are known as Kalasaji Maizanko." And of course, I immediately twigged then, you see. Zanko is the little tuft of hair that the Mohammedans, when they have, is a little tuft of hair they've got. And as far as possible, they keep that little tuft of hair. They may be shaven in every other part, but there's this little tuft of hair at the top, which is known as Zanko. So, and Maizanko means the owner or possessor of this little tuft, you see. So I said, "Yes, I know it's his uncle." I said, "But then what about it?" "Well," he said, "now," he said, "you'll have to be a Mohammedan." So, of course, I then got a discourse on the importance of having my uncle. Of course, he did it all in the language, but I had to translate into English. And very briefly, you see, we sat there and he told me, he said, "Now," he said, you must look after that," he said, "because that's very important." He said, "When you die, don't forget," he said, "when you die," he said, "your body is there, but," he said, "your soul leaves your body complete with your zanko." He said, "But before it leaves," he said, "as you're lying there in your last sort of earthly days, you're not sure, your soul doesn't know which way to go. But," he said, "Allah is keeping an eye on you, and you're going to pass either. If you're not going to die, he may pop you back again, because this earth is known as the devil's playground, otherwise hell, or otherwise." So he said, "There you are. You don't know whether you're going to go up or down to the first heaven. But then if Allah decides that you're going to die, he then watches you. And there's a little bridge. It's only the width of a hair. And your soul is then on the edge of the bridge, and you've got to walk over it. And according to how good you've been or what you've done, you will then pass from one heaven to the other. But there you are. If you get over the bridge, that's good. But if not, if you think you're going to fall, and Allah thinks you're going to pass," you use the word just as for a test, you know, the army test. "If you're going to pass your test, Allah then reaches forward, holds you by the zanko, and takes you over. And then you go to your next heaven," and so on, as the case may be. He said, "But you'll never get up to the seventh heaven, or anyway." He said, "You'll be lucky if you'll get to the two." But anyway, he said, "There you are. So keep your zanko. Remember that God will help you with your zanko." So I'm still hanging on to my zanko even now, and I'm over 70. Anyway, that's, by the way, this was just a sort of a little interlude of how... bringing me again into their customs and thoughts and the way they express themselves, all in the language, but I've never forgotten it. And I, so there we are, seven heavens, and going over with your zanko.
Have to keep your zanko.
Yes. Anyway, so, but the remainder of the time in Zaria was very busy with all the recruit training and again learning as much as possible of the various tribal customs. This was the first time that I was involved in a funeral. One of our recruits died. Again, this is where you have the benefit of your Africans who are so understanding in these things. And so this recruit died. I think it was a burst appendix or something. I don't know. Anyway, he died. But it was my responsibility to see that he was buried, because he was one of my recruits. Well, the sergeant explained who he was, because I knew what tribe he came from and all the remainder of it. So now in this case, this was one of the cases whereby, knowing the tribal customs and the rights, I was able to be of use. I say I was, but helped by these Africans. Now, in this case, this man, I had all his charms, his jujus, or whatever you like to call them, were collected off the body and given to me, which we wrapped up. We went and he was buried. We had a cemetery outside the things, and he was buried as per tribal customs. In this case, he wasn't a Mohammedan. He was a Dakakeri. And so he was buried with representatives from the Dakakeri tribe, and they were buried as to tribal custom. I had to take out the sand, the grave soil from the grave, to put in with this. We had cigarette tins. It held 50 cigarettes, these round tins. It was a cigarette tin. So all these charms were in this tin, plus the soil from the grave, and then that was sealed and parcelled and sent away to the district officer with a full description of everything that had happened. And that was then taken to his parents, and it was buried in his own village. But this was again how important death is to the Africans as well. And it meant such a lot. So all that I could do, of course, was to learn all about what was done. His friends told me they buried him as per custom, and in his case they had to put a stick in top and bottom, which would grow, and that would represent the gravestone as well. A twig that they cut, they went to the appropriate twig, as they would say, and that was planted, and head and tail of his top and bottom of his grave, and he was buried according to their customs, and they said their own service, and then that was sent off. So that really brought it home to me how important it was. All that I could do was to watch, and then at the end I saluted the grave and paid my respects and word of Hausa, which they could understand, and sort of may his soul rest.